as John said, what I want to do today is talk a bit about capital flows and the Australian dollar. So capital flows have got a fair bit to do with where the currency is going, and I'll get on to that a bit later. But let me talk first about capital flows. So the Australian economy has been a net recipient of capital inflows from the rest of the world for all of its history, pretty much, potentially even prior to its modern history, it was a net receiver of capital from the rest of the world. These net capital flows, which are the difference between foreign investment in Australia and Australia's investment abroad, are the financial counterpart to Australia's current account deficit. So put differently or equivalently, investment in the Australian economy has consistently exceeded domestic savings for the last couple of hundred years, and this gap has been funded from offshore. So Australia's current account deficit and the associated capital flows are a good thing, not a bad thing, as you might sometimes read. So they're very much a good thing. Cross-border capital flows allow for a more efficient allocation of global capital and can be highly beneficial. In Australia's case, as I said, for many years, for a couple of hundred years or so, foreign investment has been attracted by the favourable returns on offer here and has helped to expand our domestic capacity. Most recently, this has been particularly obvious in the role foreign investment has played in expanding the capacity of the Australian resources sector in order to meet the growing demand for our bulk commodities, particularly from China. Again, I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. So although capital inflows has been a consistent feature of Australia's balance of payments, the composition of these capital flows have varied significantly over time. So what I want to do today is discuss some of these compositional changes in capital flows in more detail, and I'll also comment on some aspects of the relationship between these capital flows and the dollar, although this is not straightforward. But at a basic level, in terms of thinking about how it interacts with the dollar, capital inflows can be thought as representing the willingness of foreign investors to purchase Australian dollar assets, and the exchange rate is the price which adjusts so that those foreigners are willing to invest in Australia and also maintain that exposure to Australia. So I'll talk a bit about what's been going on with capital flows over the last couple of years and conclude with a few observations on where things might be going for capital flows and potentially also, therefore, for the dollar. So let me give you some pictures. So don't pay too much attention to the different bars. The thing to notice here is that they switch around a bit. That's the main. So the black line is the net amount of capital inflow that's been coming into Australia for the last 20 years or so. And you can see we've been a net receiver of capital flow inflows throughout that time. The other bars are various indicators of the composition of those capital flows. I'm going to spend most of the next little while going into that in a bit more detail. But the main thing to notice is towards the right-hand side there is there's been a bit of a switch around in some of the composition of those bars. You can see the light blue bars have switched from being positive to negative, which is inflows to the Australian banking sector. And the other one to notice is those orange bars have changed shape a bit as well, and the green bars, which are flows into the mining sector and flows into the government, which I'll come to in a minute. But the main thing to notice is while that black line has been fairly constant, the composition of those other bars has been switching around a bit. So in the decade prior to 2007, the net inflow of capital to the Australian economy averaged around 5% and peaked at almost 7% just prior to the onset of the financial crisis, as John said, in mid-2007. Since then, net capital inflows have actually declined to be just under 3% currently. So this decline in capital in net inflows has also coincided with a marked reduction in gross capital flows. So capital flows both ways. Australians invest abroad, foreigners invest in Australia. The net of those is that black line. But the gross numbers, which are this, which is adding up, so down the bottom what I've done is added up the amount of money that Australians are investing abroad, and the amount of money that foreigners are investing in Australia. That's for Australia, and then for the world, done the same thing. And you can see in 2007, particularly on the global number, that peaks then, and then it drops away markedly. So cross-border capital flows have dropped off significantly since 2007. Less so here than elsewhere, but it's also true in Australia. So at the moment, Australian investment in Australia has gone from 17% of GDP in 2006 to around 6% of GDP currently. Australians' investment abroad has fallen from 12% of GDP to be about 3% currently. So, as I said, as well as the decline in gross flows, there's been a marked change in their composition, and these are the three things I want to talk about. So there have been reduced inflows into the Australian banking sector. So this is when the Australian banking sector issues debt offshore and foreigners buy it. Those flows have reduced quite considerably and actually have even turned around and gone the other way of late. There's been increased FDIs, foreign direct investment flows. So a marked increase in foreign direct investment inflows, and that's mostly been into the resources sector over the last few years. And thirdly, a marked increase in foreigners' purchases of Australian government debt. Australian government issues all its debt in Australian dollars, so these are foreigners buying government debt issued in Australia. So I'll discuss each of these in turn. But again, this table gives you the overall story. So if you look at the top there, inflows, net inflows into the private sector averaged 5% of GDP prior to 2007. They're just under 2% now. If you look at the next line for banks, it was 5.5% of GDP. So foreigners were buying debt issued by the Australian banking sector, averaging around 5.5% of GDP each year prior to 2007. And you can see that number's been negative over the past 5 years, which means the Australian banks have been net repayers of debt over the last little while. If you go down to the second last line, the resources sector, prior to 2007, the ABS didn't even bother to split out the resources sector because it actually wasn't that big a deal. From 2008 to 2013, when we have this data available, you see that inflows into the resources sector have been about 1.5% of GDP. And then finally, at the bottom there, the public sector, there was not much change at all in foreigners' holdings of Australian government debt prior to 2007. But over the last 5 years, foreigners have been buying Australian government debt to the tune of about a bit over 2% of GDP each year for the past 5 or 6 years. So let me talk about each of the banks, the mining sector, and the government in turn. So net inflows, the decline in net inflows to the banking sector reflects two main factors. The first is a shift in the composition of the funding of the Australian banking sector. So the onset of the financial crisis in 2007 led to a reassessment by the banks of the risks associated with different types of funding, and has seen banks shift their funding base towards domestic deposits and away from debt. This development does not reflect a lack of appetite from the rest of the world for Australian bank paper. Australian banks now can issue debt about as cheaply as they've ever been able to issue. So it's not that people don't want to buy it, it's just the banks have decided that they're going to shift their funding base more towards deposits and away from debt. The second reason why the banks aren't issuing so much debt is because they're not lending as much as they used to. So there's been a marked reduction in growth of lending by the banking system now relative to its pre-crisis levels. So as a result, the banks have scaled back their pace of offshore debt issuance. So what this graph shows you is just the net purchases of Australian bank debt by foreigners. You can see prior to 2007, pretty solidly positive. And this is when the banks used to run the line that they were funding the country, which in net terms, the two numbers added up to be the same thing, but it concealed a whole lot of movements in the gross flows. And the fact, and that was clearly shown not to be the case after that, the country has still continued to receive capital inflows, and the banking sector has actually turned around and been a net repayer of debt in 3 of the past 6 years. So those negative bars means the banks are issuing less debt offshore than is actually maturing. So that's one of the main shifts in the capital flows that we've seen over the last few years. The slowdown in lending growth by the banks has been particularly evident in the slow pace of lending to the business sector. And that's related to the second key development in the composition of Australian capital flows, which has been a marked increase in net flows to the corporate sector. So the corporate sector is raising money directly from offshore rather than it going through the banking sector. So net inflows to the corporate sector have stepped up from an average of around 1.5% of GDP prior to 2007 to around 4% currently. And investment in the resources sector has really been the main story there. So since 2011, around 70% of foreign investment in the Australian corporate sector has been directed to the resources sector. And as outlined in previous work that the RBA has done, A very significant share of the increase in investment in resources in resource projects has been funded through foreign direct investment in the form of retained earnings. So what that means is, so BHP and Rio, at least more foreign-owned than they are Australian-owned, someone like a Chevron is obviously completely foreign-owned. All the money that they've been bringing in for their large resource projects, which have been going on over the last few years, and in the case of the gas sector is still going on, has pretty much all been funded from offshore. BHP and Rio have funded that out of their profits. Someone like a Chevron is just bringing in cash from the US and bringing it in directly into the country to pay for their investment. To the extent that BHP and Rio in particular have bothered to borrow any money, and the two of them haven't actually borrowed all that much, they've accessed offshore debt markets directly. So BHP issues debt directly into the market rather than borrowing through the Australian banking sector. Now, one of the reasons for that is BHP can borrow cheaper than any Australian bank, so it doesn't make sense for them to go and borrow from a bank, pay the bank for the privilege of doing that when they can actually issue cheaper themselves. Not necessarily good news for the banking sector, who would love to lend to BHP, but good news for BHP shareholders. So the third... So if you can see here, those purple bars are inflows to the mining sector from 2008. I said the reason why I can't show you that before then is because the ABS didn't bother to split out the data for the mining sector prior to that, but basically there wasn't a lot going on in the resources sector prior to that. But you can see, particularly in the last few years, there have been pretty sizable inflows into the resources sector. So that's those purple bars there over the last few years. And the third key development are those orange bars, which has been net purchases of debt of public sector debt. And you can see there, for most of this period of time, and particularly around 2010, 11 and 12, there have been pretty solid purchases of Australian government debt from offshore. So that's, as I said, that's those orange bars. And what's happened is that we've seen so what I'm showing here now is, if you take the stock of debt that the Australian government's issued, and then how much is that is held by foreigners? And the answer is, at the moment, it's around about 70%. So 70% of the debt the Australian government's issued has got out there at the moment, 70% of that is held offshore. In the case of the states, as Pally well knows, it's more slightly less than that. It's around 30%. So you can see there. So the other thing to note here is that from 2007, so around here, to today, the stock of debt issued by the Commonwealth Government has gone up five times. So it's gone from $50 billion to over $250 billion currently. At the same time, the foreign ownership share has gone from 50% to 70%. So it's gone from 50% of $50 billion, so about $25 billion was held offshore. Today it's 70% of $250 billion. So over $150 billion worth of Australian Commonwealth debt is held offshore. In the case of the states, those net purchases have been a bit less than the Commonwealth, and it hasn't quite kept pace with issuance by the states, so the share has been declining over the last few years. There's still been, foreigners still buy state government debt each year, but just not quite as fast as the states are issuing it. So the increased foreign investment in Australian debt appears to have been underpinned by increased what's called official holdings of Australian assets. So that means other central banks around the world holding Australian government debt, or sovereign wealth funds holding Australian government debt. We think that's the case, but we don't actually know that for a fact. The ABS statistics don't tell us who exactly holds the government debt, nor does the AOFM actually know, or at least they don't have a great idea. And so we know how much is held offshore, but we don't actually know who it is. We can get a reasonable idea by looking at the balance sheets of other central banks to the extent they publish them, and that shows that there has been a marked increase in holdings of Australian government debt. But the largest holding of official reserves in the world, which is held by the Chinese, some $3.5 trillion, a reasonable number, we don't know how much Australian government assets they hold, or Australian assets and Australian government debt in particular that they hold. We know they hold some. We guess that they hold some. We don't know, again, don't know that for a fact. But if you think about it, a small share of $3.5 trillion is still actually a fairly large number. As I said, we don't have any great sense of how much exactly they're holding. But we know that it's positive. So why are these sovereign asset managers buying Australian government debt? for a couple of reasons. One, Australian government debt yields remain relatively high compared to other yields of other governments. It's not so much that ours are high, it's to some extent more that others are extremely low. Australian government bond yields at the moment are about as low as they've been in the country's history. It's just that everywhere else in the world they're even lower. The Australian government is one of the few countries which retains its AAA credit rating, and the combination of a decent risk, decent return and not much risk makes it a fairly attractive asset, and so people have been buying them. My general sense is that the bulk of sovereign asset managers now have Australian dollars as part of their portfolios, so there aren't many new buyers yet to emerge from the woodwork. And the main chunk of diversification, if I go back here, when did people start switching into Australian government debt? It was really around 2010, 2011 and 2012, and that was when things in Europe weren't looking quite so hot, and there was probably a bit of switch out of Europe into Australia around that time. And as I said, Australia was at that, from around that time, a number of other jurisdictions were downgraded, including even the US, from a credit rating point of view, and Australia is one of the few AAAs left out there. So these changes in the composition of Australia's capital inflows have also been reflected in the changes in the composition of the stock. So these are the flows. You add them up over a number of years and you get the stock. So this is a graph of the stock. Again, there's a fair bit there, but a couple of things to notice. The light green bits at the top, which is the amount of debt issued by the banks held offshore, that's smaller now relative to the size of the economy. It's smaller in 2013 than it was in 2007. At the same time, the orange bit, which is the stock of government debt held offshore, has gone up relative to the size of the economy. And then the sort of purpley bit, which is the resources sector, has also gone up. So that again just shows you that have differences in flows for a number of years, and it gets reflected in stocks. So that's the liability side of the country's balance sheet in terms of the foreign liabilities. The asset side is on the other side, and that hasn't actually changed that much over time. It's remained relatively constant, and the composition of that actually isn't all that much different. If I do this in net terms, so that was the gross stocks. This is liabilities less assets. So the Australian economy has a net foreign liabilities position, which means more foreigners hold more of our assets than we hold of theirs. You can see that that's actually remained pretty constant for the last decade or so. It's been just under around 55% of GDP for the last decade or so. But again, the composition of that has changed. You can see much more long-term debt, much less short-term debt. And that again is mostly reflects the fact that the government debt tends to be longer term, bank debt tends to be shorter term. We've got more government debt, less bank debt. So that's shifted from long-term to short-term, short-term into long-term. At the same time, the banks, when they are issuing debt, are tending to issue much more longer-term debt and much less shorter-term debt. The other thing to notice is that purple line down at the bottom, which is the net equity position. So for most, pretty much all of the Australian, at least all of the known, the time of period we actually have data for, foreigners have held more equity investments in Australia than Australians have held abroad. You can see right at the end there, the most recent observation, that's flipped around. So it's, as of today, Australians now hold more equity investment offshore, mostly through the superannuation sector, than foreigners hold in Australia. So we now have a net positive equity position. And so that's the first time that's been the case in the country's history. That change in the composition of the stock of foreign liabilities has had a noticeable impact on what's called the net income deficit. So this is the liabilities we owe. We obviously have to pay people interest on that or equity returns on that. This compositional shift is actually the way that's changed has seen the net income deficit decline recently to around its lowest share of GDP in a number of decades. Now, one part of that is because government yields are so low. But also the other part is because we've got much more government debt in our foreign liabilities, costs us much less to service that than it costs the banks to service their debt. So the current account deficit has narrowed because it's not costing us as much to service this stock of foreign liabilities as it did a decade ago. So given that changes in gross flows to the banking, resources and government sector have had a significant influence on changes in the composition of capital flows over recent years, it's worth considering what factors might affect these flows in the future. And so I'm going to give you some idea about where this all might go, and I'll eventually get on to what that might actually mean for the currency. By way of warning, economists' forecasts of the Australian dollar are generally not worth the paper they're written on, so you can take all of this with a grain of salt. But anyway, newspaper columnists and anyone else's forecasts aren't worth the paper they're written on either. But anyway, this is how I think these flows are going to evolve. What that actually means to the currency is possibly another leap. But anyway, in terms of the banking sector, it doesn't look like things are going to change anytime soon. The banks are likely to continue with little net debt issuance in the period ahead. At the moment, basically, they're just issuing enough debt to cover that's what's maturing. To the extent that investment in the non-resources sector is likely to be intermediated by the banking sector, and the RBA's forecasting a pickup in investment outside the resources sector, you might see a bit more bank lending to the corporate sector. We're certainly expecting that will happen. So that might see a bit more funding requirements for the banking sector, but we don't think that's actually going to amount to all that much. And at the moment, deposit growth still continues to outstrip lending growth. So the banks aren't going to have to issue a lot of debt to fund any increase in business lending. Turning to the resources sector, the investment phase of the resources boom, as you read repeatedly in the paper, has peaked, and a number of resources projects are moving into the production phase. Basically, all the iron ore projects are pretty much done, and they're pumping out a lot more iron ore exports. The gas projects have still got a fair bit to go over the next 12, 18 months or so, and around about the end of next year, they'll start pumping a lot of gas out as well. So we're moving from the investment phase into the production phase. As I mentioned earlier, foreign investors have played a large part in the financing of this investment. And so as we move to the production phase, we should see reduced capital inflows. At the same time, you know, the resources sector has been doing this investment for a reason, which is to produce more resources and export them. So as they produce more resources, you should see an increase in the resource sector's export revenue. As I said, that's the whole point of the investment. So the combination of higher revenues and lower capital expenditure should be expected to see an increase in resource sector profits, and particularly to an increase in the share of these profits that are paid out as dividends to investors. And it's already very evident in the case of BHP. Given that the resources sector is largely foreign-owned, and even in the case of BHP is more than 50% foreign-owned, this would be accompanied by an increase in dividend payments to foreign investors. So foreign investors hold a decent chunk in BHP. BHP has to pay them dividends. That's counted as an outflow, according to the statistician. And this is where it gets slightly more complicated in terms of thinking about what that means for the Australian dollar. Reduced capital inflows would normally mean a lower Australian dollar. But when it comes to the resources sector, as I said, things get complicated. BHP basically earns all its money in US dollars. And so what they do when they come to paying their dividends to their foreigners, it never actually comes into the country. It stays out, so it never gets converted into Australian dollars. All they need to do to bring into the country is what they need to pay their Australian shareholder base, the money they need to pay their Australian workforce, and whatever taxes they happen to have to pay. Those are the only flows they need to do where they're converting US dollars into Australian dollars. All their other flows, including a lot of their investment flows, have been in US dollars the whole time. And so while you might expect that as we transit from investment to production, you'd like to see less capital inflows, whether this means the currency is higher or lower result gets complicated. Moreover, it gets even more complicated if you look at the statistics, because the ABS assumes that the money does actually come into the country and then it goes back out again. And so you'll see capital inflows which aren't actually happening. They're sort of mostly staying offshore the whole time. So that's probably a level of technicality beyond what you actually want to hear. But anyway, as I said, it's important when you try and think about what that actually means for the currency to get a handle on that. So by and large, though, we'd expect there'll be less capital inflows coming into the resources sector, which probably means a lower currency. If you think about the outlook for the investment, the flows into the public sector, while the foreign ownership share of Australian government debt has declined a little from its peak in the last year or so, it still remains at a historically high level. As I said, we think a fair chunk of that is held by sovereign investors. They tend to be very slow moving, and they're not generally in a hurry to adjust their portfolio allocations. So we generally think those holdings are pretty sticky, and they're not likely to suddenly turn around and dump those holdings anytime soon. Moreover, the recent data we have suggests that demand for Australian government debt from offshore still remains fairly robust. So we're still expecting reasonable inflows there, but probably not as large as they've been in the past. The one unknown around purchases of Australian government debt really is Japan. Japanese have always held sizable shares of Australian government debt. And while there's limited evidence to date that the program of quantitative easing in Japan, which really ramped up about 12 months ago or so, there's not much evidence that's encouraged investors in Japan yet to substantially increase their purchases of other countries' assets. The most recent data suggests that demand might be starting to pick up. And again, if that picks up any time soon and in any sizable and with any size, it's a fair likelihood a fair chunk of that will find its way to Australia, because Australia is generally fairly popular with the Japanese. So notwithstanding the possibility of these flows from Japan, the net implication of all of those three things, so if I take the first three and forget about the last one for the minute, the net implication of those developments is that one might be expected to see reduced capital inflows in the period ahead, with the possibility of a consequent further decline in the Australian dollar. We've seen the dollar come down about 10% from around about this time last year. If these things come to pass and nothing else changes, then we might expect to see the Australian dollar fall some further. And this, as we've been saying, the Reserve Bank have been saying for quite some time, that would be very helpful in achieving balanced growth in the economy and bring it more, the dollar, a bit more into line with the way our terms of trade have been going of late. As I said a little while ago, the ability of economists to forecast exchange rate movements is notoriously poor, but at least those first three things and the possibility of that fourth one give you some idea of the sort of things you might be wanting to look out for in terms of the dynamics of capital flows in the period ahead and what that might mean for the currency. So let me finish up by saying the main point of my talk today was just to run you through some of the main changes which have happened in the composition of capital flows into the country over the past 7 years or so, and give you some idea about how they might change in the period ahead. So the main development has been, firstly, a marked reduction of offshore debt issuance by the Australian banking sector, and that's a trend which is probably going to stay that way for the period ahead. Secondly, there's been a sizable capital inflow, at least according to the statistician, to fund the resource investment boom. As that investment boom is now transiting to the production and export phase, I'd expect those capital inflows to decline and their composition change. And then thirdly, there's been a marked increase in foreign holdings of Australian government debt. While this mightn't get much bigger anytime soon, nor is it likely to go away anytime soon. So the playing out of those three factors with the possible wildcard of Japan, I think, are going to be some of the major forces affecting the direction of the currency and also the composition of Australia's capital flows over the period ahead. So let me finish there and have a bit of lunch and then give you time to digest some questions and come back in about 20 minutes. So thanks very much.
I'm going to ask Guy the first question just to kick it off. There was an article on the front of today's Fin Review, which I know is a bit of a Fairfax beat up potentially, about the AAA rating. And Costa at our table asked a question about the AAA rating while we're eating and where you see that for Australia, whether we are at risk, and sort of what that might mean currency-wise, not so much if we are to be downgraded, but if there was some noise around the country's rating.
Okay. I don't, despite what you might read in the papers, I don't think there's much risk of that. I don't necessarily always have a particularly high opinion of rating agencies, to be frank. But, you know, if you look at and it reflects exactly on what I was showing during the talk. So we've had, yes, Australia uses capital inflow for the last couple of hundred years. At the moment, actually, we've got less capital inflow than we've had most of those, certainly the last 30 or 40 years, and there's a reasonable chance, as I was saying at the end of the speech, there's going to be less rather than more capital inflow going forward. So that's not so much of an issue. If you look at the state of our fiscal position, and not staying well clear of anything to do with the most recent budget, but relative to anywhere else in the world, pretty much, and relative even to our own history and anyone else's history in the world, the Australian government both at Commonwealth and at state level is not carrying all that much debt. So on any of those metrics, you'd have to be really surprised if a rating downgrade was anywhere near the in offing. And if you map that to the local situation here, I mean, the state government here in South Australia, as Paoli well knows, is borrowing basically as cheap as it's ever been able to in its whole history. So notwithstanding the fact that, you know, South Australia doesn't have a AAA rating, still able to issue as much debt as they want to, well, not quite as much as they want, you know, issue debt without worrying about being able to fund it at about as low an interest rate as ever been the case in the country's, in the state's history. And so, you know, the government, yes, needs to maintain a prudent fiscal stance, but I don't think should be too hung up about what exactly the rating happens to be.
Michael Dozik from Funds SA. You talked about the reduction in the composition of the flows from the banking sector to potentially sovereign wealth institutions, etc. How does their hedging policy impact on the Australian dollar? For example, the banks traditionally hedge their currency exposure, whereas foreign investors, bondholders, would typically leave it unhedged.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So we have a debate about that internally and don't necessarily come up with a consistent the same answer. What I would say, I mean, so yes, you're right, the banks hedge, which means, so the banks, when they borrow US dollars, will swap that back into Australian dollars because that's what they want to lend to their customers. Whereas if I'm a foreigner and I'm buying an Australian government bond, I actually want to hold on to the Australian dollars. But when the banks hedge their borrowing, so when they're swapping their US dollars into Australian dollars, someone else is on the other side of that wanting to hold that Australian dollar exposure. So there's still someone out there who wants that net Australian dollar exposure. So I don't think the hedge, I mean, as I said, in the end, what determines the currency is the net appetite of the rest of the world to hold Australian dollar assets. How they exactly do that, I don't think makes too much difference to the overall level of the currency. So I don't think the different hedging policies of the banks and the sovereign asset buyers makes all that much difference. But it's, yeah, as I said, that's my view. As I said, there are other people who work with me who don't hold exactly that same view. So it's a good question.
Thanks, Guy. Joe Burt from Bank SA. It's a similar question. I was prepared to ask a question about speculative positioning in the A-dollar and offshore futures contracts and other things. But in light of your presentation, perhaps how would you talk from a central bank perspective in holding foreign reserves? The increase in our bond holdings offshore between 10, 11 and 12 was while the A-dollar was above parity. And hence probably a good reason to drive it higher. Since then and now, the yield curve has steepened, the A-dollar has fallen. As a central banker holding these Australian assets, clearly you're losing on market price on the yield and also holding on the A-dollar. What goes through the central bank in terms of when is it important to cut and run from a trader's perspective or from yourself, how you might think of that? Thank you.
One of my responsibilities is to manage the currency, the Australian foreign exchange reserves. Now, we're Australian, we obviously can't hold Australian dollars in our foreign exchange reserves. That doesn't work. But and we'd actually love to hold Australian dollars in our foreign exchange reserves because it actually pays us a yield. Instead, we have to hold US dollars and Japanese yen and euros, which don't pay us anything. So. Your question would be a problem we'd love to have, actually. But to the extent I get into the minds of my counterparts elsewhere around the world, most of them are interested. As I said, they're very much buy and hold investors. As you said, a number of them bought in when the currency was above parity. But I think that, you know, they're interested in the diversification point of view, to which the currency is sort of a bit of a secondary consideration. They're interested in the yield very much, but the yield is still attractive where it is now. And that a lot of them don't, unlike us, we have to mark to market on a daily basis. A lot of them don't have to mark to market, so they don't worry too much about the sell-off in yields or any sell-off in yields. So I think they're very much interested in having Aussie dollars as a permanent part of their portfolio, which, as I said in my speech, I don't think there's any risk of that changing anytime soon. As long as the Australian economy is still travelling okay and whatever, I just don't think that's going to change. As I said, if the currency got a lot cheaper, they might decide to increase their allocation, but where it is at the moment, I don't see them decreasing it.
I might just jump in there from an anecdotal perspective. SAFA thinks that about 30% of our debt is held offshore. One investor is the Swiss National Bank. So you may remember about 2 years ago, Guy, when the Swiss franc came under a lot of pressure and the government and the central bank was worried about the appreciation of the Swiss franc. So in terms of doing their own QE, they've grown their balance sheet to about 700 billion euro, something
US,
like Swiss,
dollars.
US dollars. They're now going to invest that money. And we think that the Swiss National Bank's got about $50 billion of A-dollar assets they hold in A-dollars because they've expanded their balance sheet. Now they've got to invest it. And we know they're one of the largest holders in SAFA bonds, and they've actually set up an office in Singapore now because that's where they're investing. They don't want to hold just US dollar assets. So that's a massive change that's come about from QE, where certain central banks have had to go and buy, you know, global assets. And the other thing is they are very attracted to the liquidity in the A-dollar. So, you know, it's all about their currency and protecting that. So if they lose a percent on the interest rates or they, you know, rates back up a percent, they're not so worried about that as the underlying currency relative to the euro or the US dollar.
Hello, Guy. It's Russell from the Advertiser, if you'll take a question from the media. When you say that the Reserve Bank doesn't know who owns the federal government and state government debt, if you go to the government, to Treasury or Office of Financial Management, will they tell you?
No, so they don't know either. So who knows? They obviously have to pay interest on the debt, right? So they have to, but they pay that to what's called a custodian who manages the holdings on behalf of the end investor. And those custodians have non-disclosure agreements where they don't have to disclose who they're holding it on behalf of. So they'll tell the ABS whether it's a foreigner or a domestic entity who's holding it, but not who. So neither, and this has come up a few times in the last few years, so neither Treasury or the AOFM have an exact idea, or us, have an exact idea as to who exactly is holding it. The custodians know, but they have non-disclosure agreements that they're not to say. As I said, we can try and get some handle on it by looking at what information other central banks publish, but that's fairly incomplete. So no, it is very much an incomplete picture.
G'day, Bruno Bellon from Commonwealth Bank. Thank you, Guy, for the presentation because it explained very well from a mechanical point of view, I suppose, what's been driving the currency and also those things on the outlook as well. I just wanted to ask a question, given that background in terms of there are flows in and out which control, well, obviously have an impact on the value of the currency. Over the past year or so, we've had the Reserve Bank coming out and offering an opinion in terms of the level of the currency. And obviously, uncomfortably high has been mentioned a few times. So given that the currency is ultimately determined by mechanical movements, is there much value in a central bank offering an opinion in terms of whether it's too high, too low, or just right?
I mean, I think, you know, our opinion is for whatever it's worth. It was just, if we look at from a policy point of view, a lower exchange rate would, I think, deliver a more balanced growth outlook for the economy. So that's so part of the reason why we're saying things like that is, you know, reflecting on the policy considerations. But it's also looking at the fact that if the long-term drivers of the currency, things like the terms of trade in particular, would suggest that, you know, in the medium term, it's more, you know, we think the currency is more likely to be lower rather than higher, and including for the things I was talking about today. You know, whether or not that's going to be, it's our opinion. Others obviously have different opinions. But it's as much to say, it's much to make at least people think about it, particularly going back to the question you might have asked about, you know, sort of more shorter term focus on the currency and thinking more about, well, in the medium term, what are those sort of medium term drivers and what do they suggest about the potential direction of the currency? And those medium term drivers, and combined with the sort of stuff I was talking about earlier, very much suggest that, you know, it seems like the currency is more likely to be, you know, going down rather than up from here.
Hi, Guy. I'm Peter Tyson from JB Weir. Thank you for your talk today. It's left much to ponder on for us. One of the graphs you showed, I saw today, had our the net liability position across all sectors within Australia, and it had the graph from 2007 to 2013. Yep. Looked like it had gone from kind of high 70s to low 80s. So despite the public increase in net debt position, overall it didn't seem like it had changed too much from an overall picture. Just wanted your views on Australia's liability position overall and how you see that.
So that's not something which I worry about too much at all. And so the stock is accumulation of a whole bunch of flows, and so definitionally. But so the fact that we have used those capital flows to fund investment over any number of years means that, you know, the stock of liabilities goes up. But as you said, for the last 10 years or so, it hasn't actually changed all that much. So it hasn't grown relative to the size of the economy. So, I mean, nor do I think we're at a level which is anywhere near worrisome. And to the extent that people have less appetite to hold Australian dollar assets, well, the currency goes down. And at the moment, at least, that's a development would be reasonably comfortable with. So it's not, as I said, it's not something which I think is much cause for concern. We've had, you said, that level has been maintained for about the past decade or so. Notwithstanding, in the middle of that period, we had a fair amount of global financial turmoil, and that really didn't cause the country any great problems. So the fact that we, as I said, the fact we've been through one of the biggest stress tests you could ever throw at a financial system and came out the other side without too many dramas, I think it seems to indicate to me that that's not something we should be particularly concerned about. Certainly, coming back to your question you asked me over lunch, Costa, it's not something I lose any sleep over at night. I said I lose sleep over two-year-olds, not over foreign liability positions.
And just finally, what's your NFL team?
The Cowboys. So it's about as successful as Carlton and manages their draft just as well.
One thing, Guy, I might ask is, the RBA, all of its statistics is generally as a percentage of GDP. In the last 5 years, Australia's GDP has grown faster than our peers on a global basis. So to some extent, because of that, has that put upward pressure on the dollar when you consider that our GDP and those ratios have been growing relatively faster than the rest of the world, and that on the flip side, in a world where perhaps, as the RBA is expecting, that growth is below par, or whatever the wording you use, that potentially allows that dollar to drift off over time.
Well, we can turn that around in terms of the effect. One of the biggest effects on both our economy and also on the currency over the next little while is probably going to be the stance of US monetary policy, as it's been for the last 20 or 30 years, and including over the last 5 years or so, which is again a reflection of the relative strengths of various economies. So the fact that this, one of the other reasons why sovereign asset managers were happy to invest in Australia was, as Paoli said, was because we actually were doing well, which is a good thing, not a bad thing. And the solution to that is not to drive your economy into the ground to make yourself an unattractive position to invest. But as the rest of the world hopefully becomes a happier place over the next few years, then you're right, then there's some potential for for some of those capital flows to go elsewhere in the world rather than to Australia. But as long as in the course of that we're still maintaining decent economic outcomes here. I said the solution to the, one easy way to stop people investing in you is to have a nasty deep recession. That's probably not the path we really want to go down, just to get a lower currency. So to the extent that the higher currency reflects the fact that we're doing better than the rest of the world, then obviously that puts a bit of a dampener on things, but it's much better to be in that situation than the opposite.